Okay, let's try and gather up some ideas from all of us, shall we? What is the prosperity gospel? What does it teach? We're ready over there. Thank you. What does it teach?
God promises to give us health and wealth.
God promises to give us health and wealth.
Material blessings are the norm for Christians. And these things are promised now in this life.
And they're promised now in this lifetime, yes?
That all the promises have already been realized.
Okay? We'll pass by you. You know, you've been thinking, but you've been all welcoming in the newcomers. We won't mention anything about yes. What else?
Great faith brings a lot of wealth.
Great faith brings lots of great wealth, yes?
Health, wealth, and happiness right now.
Health, wealth, and happiness right now. Anything else you want to contribute to this as the teachings of it? Okay, what's wrong with it? What is wrong with this? We'll start off this end this time. What's wrong with it?
Some of the promises are
for eternity, yes? What do you think it is?
The teachers have unnaturally white teeth.
The teachers of it have unnaturally white teeth. Thank you. So profound, that group, isn't it? Yes, deep.
Jesus teaches us not to lay our treasure on this earth.
Yes, Jesus teaches not to lay our treasures upon this earth, yes?
The Christian life is full of suffering.
Yep. Full? it does a little. It does a little, but, you know, there's joy as well, isn't there? So it's not, yes?
Emphasizing the not yet and the already.
What about emphasizing the not yet and already, yes?
It's emphasizing the not yet stuff in the already. Like, it's confusing the categories.
It's confusing the categories called not yet and already.
Yes.
What's the not yet category? What's the already category?
It's like the new creation, all that stuff.
All that stuff, the new creation. I'm giving you a hard time now, aren't I? Yes. Okay. Yeah. What's wrong with it?
Confusion between the Old and New Testament.
It's confusion between the Old and New Testament. It's a very important answer that's taken up here. You see, a lot of the promises of the Old Testament are relating to the land of Israel, to the prosperity there, whereas the New Testament is seeing the land of Israel as the type of heaven. And so it confuses the promises that are given by God to Israel with the promises by God to Christians. Okay, that's a very important part of the problem, yes? What else are problems with it? What else is wrong with it? It's pretty damning so far.
Kind of like Christians then become like treating God like a vending machine, like you're just seeking out.
Christians then start treating God like a vending machine, yes. You know, put in a prayer, get out some blessing, yes? That could be happening, yes?
Takes our eyes off Jesus and onto our own needs and desires.
Yes, takes our eyes off Jesus onto our own desires anyway, needs possibly as well, yes? We come to anything now? No? If a couple could sort themselves into that group, it would be helpful. Yes? What else?
It often exploits people.
It often exploits people. How does it exploit people? I agree with you, but how?
Well, a lot of churches that teach the prosperity gospel teach it linked to investing in their ministries, which they'll talk about, give $10 to this thing and that's a seed that you've planted and we'll pray over it and it'll multiply for you. Or even more extreme, like we'll pray over some cloth and give it to you and it'll cure your cancer or something.
So, yeah, if you give the money here, you too will have white teeth. Something like that, yes. But you're promising it. It's manipulative, isn't it? Getting people to give money to particular ministries for the sake of wealth, yes?
I mean, it's just all the values of the world squeezed into the church.
Yes, the values of the world squeezed into the church, yes? You got another one, Noah? You did so well last time, right? No? Any of us? It really is bad, isn't it? You know? Blessed are you when all kinds of troubles come upon you. It's more blessed to give than to receive. I mean, verse after verse is contrary to what the prosperity gospel preaches. But another thing that you haven't mentioned is, it's not the gospel. there's only one gospel, and money is not the key part of the gospel. It's the death and resurrection of the Lord Jesus Christ is the gospel. So it's not the prosperity gospel. Well, who can read for us Jeremiah 29 verse 11, please? Jeremiah 29, 11. Thank you, Ade.
For I know the plans I have for you, plans for welfare and not for evil, to give you a future and hope.
Okay. Why has this become a popular verse? It sounds terrific. You're quite right, yes? Sounds nice. Yes, I can spell that. Can't spell terrific.
Yeah, I mean, if you substitute yourself as the you, it's quite nice to think that God thinks about you that way.
Yes, you've got two problems now. One is, it really just is so positive about my life and my future. But secondly, the word you. Who is the you in this verse? You see, as individualists and as Christians, we read me, that my life will be full of prosperity. But the you is actually what? What's the you referring to?
Israel, who had previously been in sin.
Israel that had previously been in sin.
The exiles.
The exiles, yes. Jeremiah is written to the people who are just going, being carted off to Babylon as a result of their sinfulness. It's referring to the nation. And he's saying that God will raise up this nation again. It's a promise to the nation of Israel going through the Babylonian captivity. It's not a promise to the 21st century Christian individual. And again, that's where Angelina is right, that the whole issue of the confusion between the Testaments, that was yours, wasn't it? Yes, the confusion, I can't read it properly. Angeli? Yeah, sure. The confusion between the two testaments, you see. It's a classic in it. Now, why I raise it is because if you do searches, and please don't, but if you do searches, you'll find that it is at least the second most popular, if not the most popular verse in the world today. That's very sad. John 3:16 is pips it in most of the lists, depends which search engine you go into and the rest, as to who did the survey and the rest, but it is up there as possibly the most, but certainly the second most popular verse in the world today. That's because the prosperity gospel has spread across the world. I'll tell you something even sadder, it's spread across the poor people of the world. So you can't preach, my friends tell me, in Africa without constantly coming against the prosperity gospel. That people in terrible abject poverty are being promised wealth, health, justice now, and being given all kinds of verses from the Old Testament about God's promises to the nation Israel applied to the individual in Tanzania or Kenya or wherever it may be. It's a very sad, sad reflection. Was it true in South America too? Mexico is a popular verse. Tell us about it.
I lived in Mexico for 12 years and the charismatic church is reasonably popular and seeing that God is for us and wanting to act for our good and to bring about social justice and liberation theology.
Yeah.
Also in South America than Mexico, but
yeah, and it's a real problem because many of the things that are being promised are right. They were right for Israel at the time they were given, and they're right for us in the new creation. But in the meantime, we are physically in the old creation, and they're not for now. It's confusion of the timing, which is really an important mistake. Well, that's one side, the materialism. The other side I want to talk about was work tonight. And I've got a series of questions, and I really ran into trouble on the 1, 2, 3, 4th question because I don't know what it means. I know there's a question there, I just can't formulate it properly. And so I'm sorry about that, but there's a question here that I'm still feeling after. See, why do humans work? What do non-Christians hope to achieve by work? When did division of labour commence? What does division of labour require of us? How does division of labour work? What are the prerequisites to make division of labour work? I don't know exactly how to phrase the question. So that gives you free rein to answer anything you want, doesn't it? You know, if I can't think out the question, you can think up an answer like you like. I mean, whatever it might be. No, Jono, do not do it. I know that you are tempted at this point to think up something very creative, but
I promise I won't be creative in any capacity.
Ah, thank you. That's good. And then, what is the basis for pay differentials between jobs? Okay, take a few minutes with each other on this one. Let's get underway. There's a string of questions here which we need to move to the answers fairly quickly, because these are big topics over which the rest of the night could be spent, but we want to get to the Bible in the second half. So let's at least pick up on why do humans work?
To eat.
Because God told us to.
Because God told us to. Is that why all humans work?
Some, yeah. So made in the image of God and God works?
We're made in the image of God and God works. So even if we don't remember that we've been told to, we're still made that way, yes?
Status,
okay.
To make money,
yeah.
It's what we're told to do from the time we're born.
That's what our parents told us to do, get out there and work. Yes, they're hard creatures, yes? Sorry? Do not be bored, because life without work would be boring. So this is something about her work ethic, doesn't it? Yes?
To set themselves up for retirement.
To set themselves up for retirement. When they don't have to work. Is that it?
Yeah.
We work so as to avoid work. Mm-hmm.
Fulfilling.
It's fulfillment, yes. Okay, let's move to that second one. What a non-Christians hope to achieve by their work, yes?
Status?
Comfort, either for themselves or for their kids.
Comfort for themselves or their kids, not other people's kids, their kids, yes?
Fulfillment,
yes.
Meaning?
Validation.
Sorry?
Validation.
Purpose? Sorry?
Affluence,
yes. Oh, it should be. Yeah, it's all right, I haven't got COVID, yes.
To make a name for themselves?
Make a name for themselves, yes. That's straight out of Genesis 11, isn't it?
Fulfillment.
Okay. Any others that you've got?
Power.
The good news is I've got this recorder on, so the people who didn't turn up and listen to the recording have now got sneezes. What was that one? Power. Yes, people work for power. Yeah. All kinds of reasons. You notice one of the characteristics of Satan is he tells lies by just distorting the truth. You don't have to say black is white. You can just say black's a shade of grey. I mean, that's a more powerful lie than black's white. And so you take hold of a good thing why we work. We need to eat. We need money. We need to provide for ourselves. That we've been created by God as working creatures to subdue the world. You take the good thing and then you just twist it a little so that I work for meaning and purpose because I've been created to work, so it is part of my meaning, part of my purpose, or I work to fulfill. But then you turn that into something very, very different, that my self-identity, my significance, my importance, my gets caught up in work. But then division of labor. Who can tell me what division of labor is? Apparently some of you don't know the phrase, but it's a very classic old economics phrase.
Is it when someone's a miner and then someone's a blacksmith to turn that, like, people have specialized trades to maximize efficiency?
Yes, the community has evolved, whatever, so that different people do different labor so that the whole community is. So some of us are farmers and some are bus drivers, some are garbage collectors and some are journalists who provide for the garbage collection. Whatever the different jobs that people have, but it's a division. We don't all do the same thing. So when did division of labour commence, do you think? Who can give me the earliest example they know of division of labour?
Genesis 4,
Tobias, yes?
Cain and Abel,
that's right. One looked after crops, the other looked after animals. Classic division of labour with the very beginning of creation, right? I think there's a division between the men and women in Genesis 3 and 2 as well, in terms of the men don't have the babies, which is still basically the idea. But you get division of labour from the beginning. Right? That is, we don't work on subsistence living, where I provide everything for me by my labour. It is unlikely that many of us would survive if you had to provide everything for yourself. By helping each other, we provide, right? So, what does division of labour require of us? Did anyone come up with any decent answer to my ill-formed question?
We said a population big enough that only some people have to do all the farming, so other people can do other jobs.
Yes, yeah. A population of 3 people will still be difficult to survive. You've got to have a population big enough for enough division of labour to provide for us, yes?
We had teamwork.
Teamwork. You've got to have teamwork to have division of labour. If I'm going to do all the crops but I'm not going to give any of you, then that's not going to work, is it?
Well, sometimes it means some like self-sacrifice on our part. We can't always do what we want, would like to do in the division.
Yes, the teamwork involves self-sacrifice. But I can't do everything and have everything I want, yes?
Some way to measure the worth of labour.
Some way to measure the worth of labour. So how much crops do I need to be able to get the electricity turned on? Right? Well, I've got to go to the electricity producer, but I've got to provide crops for him and he's providing electricity. Some measure of equating, which leads us to then the last question. What is the basis for pay differential between jobs? Because there's huge differences in pay differentials. I went to my heart specialist the other day to find out that there's nothing wrong with my heart, which is 45 minutes I spent finding out that there is nothing wrong with my heart. It's good news, isn't it? How much did it cost me? $587 in 45 minutes to find out I didn't need to be there. Right? Now, I presume most of you don't earn $587.50 in 45 minutes. Right? So there's huge pay differentials, aren't there? Right? Now, what's the basis of pay differentials between jobs?
On some level, there's a skill difference.
A skill difference, yes.
On the back of that, training.
Training, yes. The heart specialist has skill, nice man, and has trained for many years, yes.
Risk,
yes, because he's taking great risks, not as much as the obstetricians do, right? I mean, the insurance policies on obstetricians are sky high, because being sued for some problem, that's massive, you see, whereas other jobs, there's not much risk at all. You know, I work for the government, no risk. Yeah?
Some sort of like perceived value, like you value one service over the other.
You value one service over the other.
Therefore you pay more for it.
And therefore you pay more for it. How do you evaluate one more than the other?
Like some things are just innately more valuable.
Some things are innately more valuable. Can you give me examples?
Okay, like your heart doctor is more important to you than paying for a coffee. So your heart surgeon.
My heart surgeon's more important than the waitress who gives me a coffee,
yeah,
which has got the cream and sugar that kills me because my heart surgeon told me I'm all right and I now pour more cream and sugar on than ever. Yes?
Supply and demand.
Supply and demand, yes.
How easily the person is replaced.
how replaceable a person is. Yes, like being a CEO of Essendon. It's easy to replace them, isn't it? Yeah? Yeah? What else?
If you're overseeing a lot of people, like your position in the workplace.
So bosses get paid less than workers because they've got the joy of overseeing people. Is not quite what you meant, was it? No? So because you've got responsibility for other people, yes?
How desirable the job is. No one wants to be a plumber, so they'll pay
more. Ah, how undesirable the job is. Because the more undesirable, the higher the pay, is it? Yeah, that's right. What makes certain jobs undesirable?
Physical conditions,
yes?
Reputation
in society, yes. Yeah, any others that we've got going for us? So we have this massive differentiation between payments, and we have this sense in which our identity, our self, our person is caught up with our work. We work so as to get a feeling of power or fulfillment or satisfaction. And some people get more power, fulfillment and satisfaction than other people because of the jobs they're doing. And the basis of these jobs, well, it can be cultural values. It can be argued this is more important than that. But of course, a society, by and large, the labours, all of them are important. Not all. You can do without some. We can do without casinos. We can do without horse races. There are some things you could do without, and it really wouldn't make that much difference. But there are other things like plumbers. That would be disastrous if they went on strike. Garbage collectors. That would be disastrous if they went on strike. Heart surgeons. Well, it just means old white fat men like me would die earlier. And we could do without that, but not me, no. Except the amount of coffee that I now can drink with cream and sugar, because apple turnovers and cream, they're my nemesis. So you see, we have this value system, but it's a bit of a wonky value system, isn't it? Because amongst other things, there's corporate coercion from the unions, which are going to go out and strike unless you give us more money. From the bosses, who will not give you more money because they say they won't make enough profit for themselves to employ you. And so they set wages for you. There's a whole range of things, you see. You could say education and skill, but you know, less educated people with less skill would still be happy to do the job and could possibly, in some cases, do the job just as well. I mean, some of the journalists on television are paid huge amounts of money. But hey, thousands of people would be happy to do the job for them on much less money. And in fact, there's an old book called Up the Organisation, which is a good read sometimes if you've got a cynical streak in you, because it points out that, you know, you reach a certain point climbing the ladder where you're employed so much, but you're paid so much that they could pay three or four people to do your job, and three or four less skilled, less able, less experienced people could do more than the one really up the top person is doing at the moment. And so actually the value system of the redistribution of money is actually pretty crazy, frankly. Doesn't work. And so Marx says, no, everybody should be paid as they need, according to their needs. And that's a much more just, fair, equitable system. It just doesn't work, that's all. When everybody's paid according to their needs, nobody works hard and nobody does the job. So you can have a system of corruption of individuals, some paid fortunes, other paid pittance, or you can have the other system where everybody's paid the same and the whole system goes bankrupt. Human nature messes up whichever way you go. It's just the nature of humans sinful. Good. Without going into groups, I want to ask you the question, where, let's quickly think it out, we've actually had one answer already, where does the Bible teach against materialism? If you're asked to give a talk against materialism, which Bible verse would you go to? Yeah?
Don't store up treasures on earth.
Don't store up treasures on earth. The one we had earlier, yes? Matthew chapter?
Six.
Yeah, that's what you were going to say. I thought you were. I could see six coming out of your mouth. Yes. Just pause to give Jono a chance.
It's really enjoying talking about how God's people will worship through truth and spirit.
Sorry?
God's people will
worship in spirit and truth in John chapter 4. Doesn't mention money particularly, but yes, you're right. Our worship is in spirit and truth, not in money.
Luke 12, the parable of the rich fool.
The parable of the rich fool in Luke 12, yes. Lord, tell my brother to divide the inheritance. Don't be covetous, says the Lord, and then tells that parable. Yes, John?
The rich man in Mark who comes to Jesus and then sets him away.
Rich young ruler in Mark chapter 10 or something like that?
Yeah, it's right there.
Daniel? Sorry? Yeah?
Ecclesiastes,
yes. The book of Ecclesiastes talks of the hopelessness of money and wealth, yes.
I don't know, does Abraham count where he's told to leave everything?
Abraham, who's told to leave everything and go to a foreign land, yes. He could have stayed and made more money, yes. No, you go there, what's wrong with you?
1 Timothy 6.
1 Timothy 6?
The love of money is
The love of money is the root of all manner of evil. 1 Timothy 6:10, yes?
Colossians 3:2.
Seek the things that are above where Christ is seated at the right hand of God, yes? What else? Where are we going?
Maybe go to Acts 4, where the believers share all of their possessions.
Yes, the believers shared their possessions. No one was hungry, yes? Well, yes, it's true. Thank you. Hebrews 9:27, yes? I won't argue about the money. It's a little lacking on references to money, but yes.
You could just go to any
you
of the
could.
Verses on the incarnation of Jesus who gave up heaven.
Well, go to 2 Corinthians 8, verse 9, and read that for us, yes? What else? Yes? James chapter 1, has anyone got James 1? I think it's about verse 9 following, something like that. No? Yes? You got it, Cameron? Is it verse 9 or something?
Nine.
Yeah?
But the worthy brother both needs exaltation and the rich needs humiliation. It's like a vow of the
Yes, the riches are like the glass, it all pass away. The lowly should rejoice in his exaltation, the rich person in their humiliation. That is, the kingdom of God reverses your financial situation.
Hebrews 10:34, you accepted the confiscation of your property because you knew that you yourselves had better and lasting possessions.
Yes, you accepted the confiscation of your own property because you actually were living for something greater than that.
I've got 2 Corinthians 8, verse 9, you said?
Where? What's that say?
For you know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ. Though he was rich, yet for your sake he became poor, so that you by his poverty might become rich.
That's the kind of thing you were trying to say, wasn't it? That out of the incarnation, you see the renunciation of wealth for the sake of salvation.
Hebrews 13:5.
Yes?
Keep your lives free from the love of money and be content with what you have, because God has said, never will I leave you, never will I forsake.
Yes, thank you. In fact, the attack on greed, materialism, covetousness, right, is more frequent in the scriptures than almost any other moral issue. That's a problem, yes, right?
I don't know if someone said it already, but do not covet.
Do not covet, yes, that's a safe one, isn't it? Right? But it's actually do not covet, it says do not covet your neighbours, ding, 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 right? But yes, do not covet. But there's more against materialism, greed, than almost any other issue in the scriptures. But our society is built on it. I think there's a verse, Ecclesiastes 4:4. I haven't looked it up. I hope I've got it right. What's Ecclesiastes 4:4 say?
Then I saw that all toil and all skill in work come from a man's envy of his neighbour.
Yeah.
This is vanity and striving after wind.
All toil, all work comes from envy of our neighbour. And this is, of course, useless. I mean, what a silly idea. I envy you, you envy me. And so we work hard to outdo each other. I mean, this is, you know, living by the Joneses next door. It's a ridiculous notion. And yet, the standard of living I like to have is the standard of living the society around about me, but one notch up above them. I don't really want to be the super rich, although some of you might want that too. But I never want to be one step behind the society. So as the whole society becomes richer, so I become richer. And I feel justified in being richer because I'm just like everybody else. Yeah. Middle class. With one notch up. Right? Is all I want. But do we need the riches that we have? No, we don't need apple turnovers and cream. We don't need to buy our coffees. We don't need actually to drink coffee for all that matters, you know. For centuries people never did and they lived quite satisfactory lives. What do we actually need and how do we live according to it? Well, I'm sorry, but that's a great failure. Angus? Thank you very much. Well read, quite loudly. Very wonderful chapter, isn't it? I devised all kinds of questions for this evening and I worked out pretty well everything I want to say is actually in this chapter. So I thought, well, about time we studied the Bible, isn't it, together. So, here are two questions I haven't got on the board for you, but not really hard for you to be able to remember them. What are the difficulties in the first parable there? And what is the point of the parable? So I just spent a few moments with each other. What's the difficulties in this parable? And what's the point of the parable? Okay, let's deal with it quickly, shall we? What are the difficulties in this parable? We'll find out from over the back here. What are the difficulties of this parable?
It was confusing. We didn't understand it.
It was confusing. We didn't understand it. What are the difficulties?
He seems to be rewarded for. The
man seems to be rewarded for doing all the evil things, yes?
Don't know what unrighteous wealth is.
Don't know what unrighteous wealth is, yes?
It could be seen that Jesus is applauding the evil man.
Could be applauding, Jesus could be applauding the evil man, yes? Who is the master? Jesus or the owner of the house? The master commends him. Is it Jesus commends him or is it the owner commends him? Yeah, there's another difficulty, yes? What else? Got no more difficulties. Absolutely straightforward, is it?
What are the eternal dwellings that mentions?
What are the eternal dwellings that's mentioned, yes? Good. Okay, what's the point of the parable then?
I guess it's to make friends. In this world, so that they'll, I guess, yeah, you're working for the kingdom. You're investing in the kingdom.
You're investing in the kingdom when you're stealing from people.
Yeah, let's go with that.
Yes. What's the point of the parable?
We didn't get to that question.
Yes, we're still dealing with the difficulties. Yes, what's the point of the parable over here?
Well, in verse 13, it says you cannot
serve both God and money. Verse 13, you went beyond the parable to answer this question, didn't you?
We already told you we didn't understand.
Yes, okay. So you went beyond it, yes? What's the point of the parable?
We didn't get that far.
Verse 9 seems to.
We didn't get that far, but he did. Yeah. Verse 9, what's it say, brother, that helps you get the point of it?
I tell you, make friends for yourselves by means of unrighteous wealth, so that when it fails, they may receive you into the eternal
job. So something to do with that, has it?
Whatever it means.
Whatever it means.
Is there sarcasm in there?
Is there sarcasm there, yes?
Maybe verse 8, where people of this world know how to deal with their own kind in their way, but if you're sons of light, maybe contrasting the two?
Contrasting the two, the people of this world and the people of light. Yeah, well done. Yes, Ron?
Oh, the manager uses power to gain friends after it's gone, so we should use our money to make friends for when our money is gone.
When our money's gone.
I.e.
in heaven. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. You're catching on to what the parable is about. I tried to capture a couple of commentaries on it. They're a very interesting commentator called Earl Ellis, whom I did know. I met him several times. I stayed in the house, same house he did several times. An old crusty American bachelor who spent his summers in the London Museum, in the British Museum, and knew everything. An astonishing man. I really had a lot of time for Earl Ellis, old crusty and bachelor as he was. But he said, in his commentary, Jesus teaches elsewhere that the reversal of this is not what I want. That's not what I want. So let's move on, shall we? Let's go to this one from G.B. Caird, who is an unbelieving kind of commentator from Oxford. If worldly men like the steward and the landlord can recognise in a crisis that their best interests will be served by keeping the good opinion of their neighbours, religious people ought to be equally astute in keeping the good opinion of God. Does pick up what some of you are saying, right? And the feeling of the thing. Likewise, Michael Wilcox, a great preacher, used to be up in Durham. Although these things, your property, ability, time, belong to this life only, says Jesus, yet what will happen to you then when you pass into that life will depend on what you are doing with them here and now. Make sure that your use of them brings you into fellowship of friends which will survive beyond death. Yes, you're picking up. It's one of those parables that if you try and sort out every detail and turn it into an allegory, it doesn't work. It all falls apart. You're not sure whether Jesus is commending deceit and robbery. But you're not supposed to read parables as allegories. You're supposed to get the main point that they're making. And the main point is, so use your money in this world that you will be received in the next. And there's certain little clues that are used, like unrighteous money. What does that kind of unrighteous wealth and the like? And the habitations, the eternal dwellings, is referring to heaven, the home that you are going to. So use your money that it'll be used in the age to come. Leave your hand in Luke 16 and flip over just very quickly to 1 Timothy 6, where, oh, the love of money's in 1 Timothy 6, but also in 1 Timothy 6 is another verse, about verse 17. As for the rich in this present age, charge them not to be haughty, nor to set their hope on the uncertainty of riches, but on God, who richly provides us with everything to enjoy. They are to do good, to be rich in good works, to be generous and ready to share, thus storing up treasure for themselves as a good foundation for the future, so that they may take hold of that which is truly life. Yeah, it doesn't say, you're rich, give it all away, become poor, because only the poor get saved. It says, you're rich, make sure you use your riches in the way that will prepare you for heaven, which will involve things like being generous, not putting your confidence in your wealth, and so on. And so there is a place for the rich Christian in this world. It's there in 1 Timothy chapter 6. But use your money, your time, your property, or whatever it is you have, for the kingdom that is coming. That's why you are completely right over there in pressing on to verse 13 and following. Because look how it goes on, you see. One who is faithful is of very little be faithful of very much. One who is dishonest in very little, also dishonest in much. If then you have not been faithful in the unrighteous wealth, who will entrust you with true riches? But if you have not been faithful in that which is another's, who will give you that which is your own? No servant, and it goes on, you see, to talk about money. You can't serve God and money. You must so use your money as to serve God. See the idea? It's not that you throw away money and don't have money. That's not the option. But you use your money in the service of God. That's what you're doing with money. because you can't love God and money. This is a radical departure. Now, he then goes on to talk about the Pharisees, who are lovers of money, so it sounds like we're dealing with the same subject, but he talks about keeping the law, and the law and the prophets won't pass away, and about justifying yourself before men, and about people forcing their way into the kingdom, and then suddenly he's talking about divorce and remarriage, and its impossibility, before you come back to money again with the rich man and the poor man, Lazarus and the man of divers wealth, the rich man. So how does it all hang together? See, one of the important ways of reading the Bible is to see each of the paragraphs as part of the chapter that occurs in, because it's all one argument that is there. Luke has put these different bits together because they reflect each other. That's why you are really smart saying, I don't understand this parable, but what does the next paragraph say? Because the next paragraph will help me understand what I didn't understand. And the next paragraph's all about you can't serve God and money. And so it's got to do with using your money in a godly fashion. And the wicked of this world know how to use their money for the future. We should know how to use our money for the future. That's the parallel, that's the point that is being made. But what holds all this together? Divorce and remarriage and the rest. Well, it's part of, now I get to Mr. Earl Ellis, it's part of an understanding of the whole bit of Luke's gospel. Jesus teaches elsewhere that the reversal of one's status is characteristic of the coming messianic age. This motif is the apparent connecting link between the seemingly ragbag collection of sayings appended to chapter 16, verse 14. What holds them together? This concept that people are forcing their way into the kingdom. This concept that the kingdom changes everything. You see, it's a new creation. It's being born again. It's seeing things differently than the way the world sees things. Don't be surprised. Do not be surprised that the football people want to sack the CEO of Essendon any more than you should be surprised that they want to sack Israel Folau, any more than you should be surprised that the Manly rugby league players wouldn't play with the team because they were being forced to wear a jumper they didn't believe in. Don't be surprised that the world does not understand us, because we are looking at the world from the viewpoint of a new creation. Completely different way of understanding. That's why I like the title of the book that Olivia gave to us, which was Revolutionary Work. Because our view of work will be revolutionary, just like next week our view of marriage is going to be revolutionary. Part of that revolution is right there in verse 18. So we'll look at that next week more. But you see, we are not the people who trade in spouses and remarry and remarry and remarry, because adultery is adultery, whether you've been down to get a wedding certificate or not. You can be married 10 times, you're still committing adultery. You can be living with someone 10 times, you'd still be committing adultery. It makes no difference. The Pharisees are good at keeping the rules and ignoring the very purpose of the rules. And so they'll have their rules and regulations that will enable them to love money. In fact, loving of money is what you can't do if you're loving God. This is pretty important for us, friends, because in our age, in our society, money is what drives the city of Sydney. I love Sydney. If you really ask me, I'm not an Australian, I'm a New South Welshman. If you really ask me, I'm not a New South Welshman, I'm a Sydney cider. And if you really ask me, I'm a citizen of heaven and don't care at all. But if there is going to be a city in this world, I love Sydney. I think it's a terrific city, it's a fantastic place. But it's driven by the love of money. That is the motivating force of most of what is happening. That's why you can't afford to buy a house, because it's driven by money. And people are always comparing the prices of their real estate because that's how much money they've got, which is totally ludicrous. Because if they sold it, they could only buy one that's the same value. So they don't actually have anything, really. You've only got a roof over your head. A roof over your head's a roof over your head, whether it's an irrelevance. But yet, that's where their money is stored up, in their house. Now, of course, we've worked it out. We do reverse mortgages when we're old, which is terrific because we can live it up, spend all the money of the value of our house and leave nothing to our children or grandchildren, which is just ideal, isn't it? Because there's no fighting over the will. You're just helping the family to stay together by giving them nothing to fight over. It's a wonderful way of money. Money drives our society. Frankly, I think it's obscene that the heart specialist charges that sum of money. I just think that's ridiculous. I just think it's obscene. Oh yes, he studied for years, but did he want to? Yes. Would he have studied the same subject? Yes. If he was offered half the money, he'd still have done it, wouldn't he? You know, med students don't do medicine just because they're going to make a mozza. They do medicine for all kinds of reasons, like they did well in the exams and they were told to do medicine. I know one fellow who came first in New South Wales and he did medicine because he came first. That's what you do if you come first in New South Wales in the HSC. So he did. He did medicine. He came first in New South Wales on it was a few years ago, so the system's different, isn't it? 3-unit classical Greek, 3-unit Latin, 3-unit English, and 3-unit maths. And so from that, no biology, no chemistry, no physics, no science. He did medicine. Right? Of course, that's the obvious thing to do, isn't it? Mercifully for the bodies of Sydney, he got converted in second year and gave up in third year. It's a great blessing for the rest of us, wasn't it? But you see, people do medicine for weird reasons and not necessarily for the megabucks. But yet when the megabucks are offered, they don't turn it down. And they suddenly justify it by saying, oh, look at all the years of study I did, I deserve it. Look at the risks I'm taking, I deserve it. People think they deserve their income. When the argument for the redistribution of wealth never really holds any logical reasoning. It doesn't work. But money and the love of money drives us. You then get the classic event of the rich man and Lazarus. But notice the key point of this parable. The key point is the resurrection. The value system of this world is not the value system of the next world. In fact, if anything, it's reversed. It's all turned on its head. The man who had everything gets nothing. The man who had nothing gets everything. Because the new age has come, the resurrection has arrived for them, and nothing is the same. You've got to view this world from the viewpoint of that world. Otherwise, your value system will be wrong. You get it? Turn with me to 2 Corinthians. 2 Corinthians chapter, I don't know, but it's on the right-hand page, right-hand column, halfway down. You can't do that on a phone. 2 Corinthians 4, verse 16. 2 Corinthians 4, 16. So, we do not lose heart, though our outer self is wasting away, our inner self is being renewed day by day. For this light momentary affliction is preparing for us an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison, as we look not to the things that are seen, but to the things that are unseen. For the things that are seen are transient, but the things that are unseen are eternal. You can't stop living in this world, but you must view this world from the world to come, or you will misunderstand this world and miss out on the world to come. Do you get the drift of it then? Work and materialism. We're not anti-materialistic. We believe in the creation, the physical resurrection. We're not against the material world, but we're not going to deify the material world. We're not going to turn it into our God, because you can't serve God and money. That's not possible. So you've got to serve God with your money. It's a different way of operating. That has massive implications for what you're going to do with your bank account. What you're going to do with the job that you do, what you're going to do with how you charge customers, how you treat people, how you... That changes everything. So I've asked our friends to lead us in prayer. I think you can do it from where you are.